Hello and welcome to the Mindfulness Medicine Certification Program. And today we're going to be going over functional medicine, mindfulness, and reproductive hormones. So, quick disclaimer before we get started, we're giving you our opinion and consider your own research and work with your physician and everything like that.
And a little summary of where we're going this weekend. So we're going to start with the big picture overview. We'll move on to look at the functional physiology. Remember that this is really important in understanding the mechanisms of action behind disease. We'll look at the systems involved, the symptoms involved with the hormonal system, and then connections to other systems as well.
And we're going to talk about body root causes and mind root causes, both as we like to emphasize we always see that there's physiologic side of things, and with any illness, there's also a corresponding or co-arising psychologic phenomena, and we find that it's most effective if we work on both, and we sometimes miss the boat if we only think about the body or if we only think about the mind. And if we think about a single mind-body process and we're able to assess four root causes in the body through functional lab testing and root causes in the mind through understanding the things that might be most impactful, in this case for reproductive hormones, then we can really get an assessment for by asking good questions and by being very aware of some of the main issues, what might be hindering progress or stopping someone from making lifestyle and nutritional changes that they might know is best for them, but they're struggling to follow through with.
And we'll look at some lab testing and give you guys some case examples, and then we'll move into the treatments from both a body and a mind perspective.
So that's the overview of what we'll be covering this weekend. And just since we didn't introduce myself, I'm Dr. Miles. And
I'm Dr. Diane.
We're looking forward to really sharing everything that we have learned about reproductive hormones, both male and female, and helping to offer some of the most recent relevant research into a functional and integrative approach and a mindfulness-based approach about how do we figure out these issues and help to deal with them. And in the big picture, we see that this is a big issue. There's a lot of people who are very interested in hormonal balance. You talk about being able to work with hormones and it'll perk some ears up and people start to think, oh, you know, that's something that either I or someone I know has struggled with. I mean, I think almost all of us, either ourselves or someone we know, has struggled with hormonal imbalance. It's very, very common.
So the statistics are pretty telling on this. So 75% of women will experience PMS at some point in their life. So right there, showing the amount of women who at some point in their life have a level of hormonal imbalance is huge. 6% of women are diagnosed with infertility, and about 10% had difficulty getting or staying pregnant. So also very, very common.
And just an aside on that before we continue, this is a hugely emotional issue and one that women spend a lot of money out of pocket to correct. Oftentimes in vitro fertilization and other things that are helping a woman to get pregnant aren't covered by insurance, but women are willing to spend a lot of out-of-pocket money because this is a big deal. To have a child is a big, big deal. So a woman who wants to have a child, who's struggling to have a child, or a couple who wants to have a child, who's struggling to do so, is very, very motivated to do testing, to make changes, to invest in their health, to invest in their capacity to bear children. So this is something not to take lightly and something it's very easy to create a niche and specialty in working with, you know, infertility. It's not sort of our number one niche or specialty, but we've done a lot of research and definitely have worked with some people who are working with getting pregnant. In fact, we have a a patient who just, she's been working for about 9 months now on getting a viable embryo, and she just...
For the second time.
She just got a viable embryo, and
implantation took and everything, so she's officially pregnant with rising progesterone and HCG levels, so...
And so she's so happy, and people, it's just such a rewarding experience to work with someone when, you know, that's able to happen, so... And 7.5% of men, we can't forget men in the infertility picture because they're more related than I think a lot of common wisdom would suggest. There's a lot of infertility issue that's on the man and not just the woman. And there are a variety of factors that contribute to infertility with men. And, you know, men are a little more reluctant, obviously, than women to go see a doctor, see a practitioner about issues in general. We just see that. I think almost all of our doctors and practitioners that we train see a majority of women in our practice, and that's because women tend to seek help a little sooner. But men, we see 7.5% will see a fertility doctor in their life. And 18% of them are of those 7.5% are diagnosed with fertility. So it is a significant issue for men, and it's an issue that's on the rise, and part of the reason why it's on the rise is environmental toxicity. And so we'll talk a lot more about that when we get into the nitty-gritty of infertility, but there are a lot of things in our environment that are basically creating issues with our capacity to bear children. And so infertility is something that isn't something that's being resolved and becoming a non-issue. In fact, if anything, it's becoming, you know, there are solutions. There are things, technologies like in vitro fertilization that are helping. And there are also increasing issues as environmental toxins increase and our lifestyles are more stressful. And there are a variety of factors that are contributing to this as being a big issue.
We also see that 52% of men are diagnosed with erectile dysfunction at some point in their lives. And we'll get into some of the root causes and the reasons behind this later. But we really see that there is both a mind and a body root cause with erectile dysfunction. And that we're going to explore some studies that are going to show that men and the way they think actually will produce more or less testosterone. And there's some studies showing that. So really interesting and a great area where we can show data and evidence of the mind-body relationship to disease.
And one of the things within that context of erectile dysfunction is premature ejaculation, and that is something that estimates are between 25 to 35% of men have an ongoing chronic issue with premature ejaculation, and there aren't good drugs, and there's not a lot of solutions for that. So we'll talk more about what is given for that and why sort of there's a difficulty in treating that a lot of times. And of course, that can cause big problems in a relationship, in an intimate relationship. And if there are problems in an intimate relationship with feelings of not being satisfied sexually, that of course then can also lead to other reproductive hormone issues and or stress and difficulty in the relationship and issues with marriages, issues with intimate partnerships. So, you know, it's something that has a very strong mind component to it, and treatment just on the physical side is rarely very effective.
So we also see that endometriosis affects about 1 out of 10 U.S. women, so 10%. And this is a pretty important statistic because the symptoms of endometriosis are so severe that oftentimes this is a huge trigger for women missing work or not being able to participate with the activities of daily living. So this 10% is really significant here.
So the drive to reproduce, as we've said, is so strong that people go to extreme lengths to be able to do that if they want to do that and they're struggling to do that. And reproductive hormone imbalances are definitely a part of that, and we'll cover specifically research just about reproduction and fertility, as well as looking at how to modulate and adjust hormone levels.
And we also see that the lifestyle choices that we make are huge contributors to hormones in general. We see that stress, that diet, that toxicity, the day-to-day choices that we're making really can impact our hormone levels. So it's going to be essential that we have an understanding of why those things are impactful and what they do so that we can, you know, educate our patients in a motivational type of way so they can make those lifestyle changes.
And in general, reproductive issues, sexual issues can take a big toll mentally and emotionally. If there's a struggle to reproduce, if there's a struggle to have good sex functioning, if there's a struggle to be able to have managed and balanced hormones, if there's severe moodiness and things around certain parts of the cycle or other symptoms as a result of hormone imbalance, this can have a huge impact on intimate relationships and self-esteem and people feeling good about themselves. And people can harbor guilt. They can harbor shame. They can feel like, you know, men can feel like, oh, I'm not manly enough if I can't satisfy my partner in this deep and profound way. And women can think they're not sexy enough or sensual enough if they're struggling with libido issues or other things. So that can be a big issue for people. And it's, you know, if we sort of think about these archetypal big things that people think about a lot and focus on a lot, you know, sex is a big one, right? The intimacy is huge. This is something people think about a lot. This is something people want to have going well for themselves, and people feel happier and healthier when that is functioning really, really well for them.
So then we also see the emotional side. We see that people, if they're in these emotionally abusive relationships, or they've had sexual trauma or, you know, past or present, if they've had things that they're carrying from past relationships, from just how they related to sex themselves, and it could even be from childhood, how sexual expression was, say, presented to them. If there was a lot of influence that sex was not an appropriate thing to be doing, that can all deeply impact the hormones. And, you know, we just see more and more in our practice that we can do all of these things around lifestyle, balance the stress and get the diet good. And if somebody has not worked through any trauma or any core beliefs they have around their sexual selves or hormonal selves, their relationship to their organs, if people are, say, upset and mad at their uterus and ovaries because of the intense pain that they experience every month, that's going to greatly impact them. So we need to really be looking at all of these different areas from both the mind and the body perspective. And we're going to see once again here in this section, this module this weekend, that the perception of stress, how we're processing things, is going to greatly impact the hormones, even sometimes more than the actual stress itself. So we have to make sure we're addressing this, you know, toxic mind component of things as well.
And unfortunately, we live in a world where sexual abuse is not uncommon. And we'll talk more about rates and statistics on that and some things that can be done around that. But unfortunately, as children, often there's issues that come up that cause trauma, and or there are abusive relationships, and not infrequently that can trickle into later life sexual function and hormone regulation. And, you know, there can be a trigger that can come up around intimate expression with another person, especially if there's been a history of trauma, and that can make a huge impact on intimate relationships and people's capacity to maintain healthy relationships and be able to maintain a healthy sex life as well. So that's a big part, and, you know, it's a little touchy to talk about because it can be so emotional for people, but it's something we do need to talk about when we're talking about reproductive hormone balance.
So part two, functional physiology.
So here we're going to go into some physiology that for many of you, will be review, and that's okay. We're really looking at the functional side of physiology enough to understand the mechanisms of action that are at work behind the different regulations of hormones, and we really need to understand quite a bit about the functional side of physiology in order to accurately be able to think through treatment protocols, because it's so easy to just see a piece of research and say, oh, I saw this research that said that progesterone is good for anti-aging, and then just give that because we want people to live longer. But if we don't understand all of the functions of progesterone and the natural cycles, and we can get into trouble. There can be sort of problems that arise from either over-prescribing or prescribing without considerations for the other systems that might be impacted and affected. And so, you know, it's so important to review the basics, and the most skilled practitioners understand and master the basics to a higher degree and are able to then think through. And what we want, our goal for you, is to be able to not just take our protocols and do that for people, but to be able to understand why each element of a protocol is in it, and to be able to adjust and edit and customize a protocol for a particular individual based on what's happening for them in their lives, and to be able to see new research that comes out and understand where that fits in and when and why, because of understanding the mechanisms of action behind. So we are going to be doing review, but we're going to be doing it in a way that's focusing and zooming in on certain key areas to help you to understand the most important things that we believe that are going to be impactful and helpful for designing treatment protocols, working with chronic hormone imbalance, and helping you to be able to talk to a client too about why you're doing what you're doing, so they're motivated to keep going and have an understanding of the purpose behind all of the lifestyle changes, nutrition changes, and supplements that they might be taking for a little while.
So I think we already covered most of this. So the idea, like Miles is saying, is that it's really just the basics help it grow. The basics provide the foundation for which we can prescribe, we can understand. If we're looking at the pathology and we get into things like PCOS and endometriosis, some of these diseases, we're going to really start to understand what are the details of the mechanisms of action behind the disease, behind why people are having pathological problems. And when we understand the mechanisms of action behind, that's when we can really take research, like Miles is saying, and incorporate it into learning a new and different treatment plan as more research comes out. So the physiology is really the foundation, the physiology. If we understand how things function, then we can understand how to fix them when they go wrong. What is the pathology behind the dysfunction? So that's really what we're doing here, is just setting this up. And it's also going to help us communicate with patients. Like, one thing that comes up when we are reviewing labs is things like sex hormone binding globulin or albumin, these binding proteins that are going to help carry hormones around in the blood. And when we're seeing things come up with, say, high or low levels of sex hormone binding globulin on the lab, by understanding the physiology, it helps us break it down in a way that patients can understand. And typically we use analogies for these types of things. But the people that tend to be, I think, the most effective in communicating things to patients are the people that can really break things down to a very, very simplistic level. And oftentimes, you know, I certainly see in myself the ability to break things down to a simplistic level is directly related with the depths of my understanding of the material. So that's really what we're doing here, is we're trying to break things down to a level that is allowing us to understand it so deeply so we can communicate that with our patients. And when we communicate with that with our patients, that really helps us understand and helps how to motivate them to change, you know, because people tend to be motivated to change, at least in our experience, when they understand why we're asking them to make those changes. So, and then, you know, Miles also mentioned the idea of protocol design. So when we really understand the mechanisms of action of what's happening behind disease, that's going to allow us to take research and really implement it into specific protocols. So the basic anatomy is just that we have the outer and inner labia that cover that introitus. That introitus is that vaginal opening. And that introitus is going to lead to the vaginal cavity where we have the cervix leading to the uterus. And then from there, the uterus is leading to the fallopian tubes, which are basically connected to the ovaries. And the transfer of the egg into the uterus is going to be when the fimbriae of the fallopian tubes basically are going to sweep the oocytes into the fallopian tubes, and that's going to allow that egg to travel down to the uterus where it's basically awaiting implantation or fertilization and implantation.
So the follicles inside the ovary, the follicle has the oocyte or the egg inside of it, and that follicle in the beginning phase, which we'll talk a lot more about, that follicular phase is developing and maturing, and actually multiple follicles are developing and maturing. And there's, once there is a fully mature follicle, there's a dominant follicle that's chosen, and then an LH surge, a luteinizing hormone surge, is going to stimulate that dominant follicle to release the oocyte out of the ovary, and then it gets swept into that uterine tube, the fallopian tube, and then to the uterus. If that egg becomes fertilized, it can then implant into the wall of the uterus, and then that will stimulate some processes that keep the pregnancy going versus menstruating later. If it's not impregnated, then the process starts over again, and after a period of time, and a new follicle is chosen in the next month for that purpose.
So in the process of allowing that egg to basically stay in pregnancy to basically maintain is the creation of the corpus luteum. So with that surge of LH and with that release of the oocyte, we're going to actually see a corpus luteum developing. And that corpus luteum is a hormone. It's almost like a glandular structure, releases hormones and releases progesterone to maintain the pregnancy. But what's also interesting that we've seen in the research is that it also will secrete some estrogen and another hormone called inhibin, which we will get into in more detail in a little while.
And what that corpus luteum is that follicular body. And that follicle, after it deposits the egg at ovulation, that follicle collapses a little bit. And it's that follicular body that is the corpus luteum. And corpus luteum is Latin, and it means yellow body. And the yellowy, there's a little bit of yellowy pigment. And the secretion of progesterone gets really significant in that second half of the cycle, where the corpus luteum is primarily secreting progesterone, and that's the main hormone that's being secreted. But it still has some granulosa cells, which we'll talk about in a little bit, and those granulosa cells are creating estrogen. So they're aromatizing testosterone. Aromatase is an enzyme that converts testosterone into estrogen. And so the granulosa cells are cells that are in the follicle. And as the follicle matures and grows in the first half of the cycle, those granulosa cells are more and more. So those granulosa cells are aromatizing the testosterone into estrogen. And the testosterone is made by the theca cells. When LH, luteinizing hormone, binds to the theca cells, then the desmolase enzyme converts cholesterol into testosterone. So the LH stimulates, there's basically on the theca cells receptor sites for luteinizing hormone. And luteinizing hormone binds to that receptor site on the theca cell, and that stimulates cholesterol to be converted into testosterone by the desmolase enzyme.
So let's back up a second, because this is very confusing. So remember, just like any other hormonal system, we have a hypothalamus pituitary glandular relationship. And here we're talking about hypothalamus pituitary and gonads, ovaries for women and testes for men. And so what we're seeing here is that the hypothalamus will release gonadotropin releasing hormone to come down and stimulate the pituitary. Oh yeah. And then the pituitary basically will release luteinizing hormone and follicular stimulating hormone. Now, what's going to determine which one of these two will be released? There's details we're going to give you, but not quite yet. Let's build this first before we add the next layer. So basically, in the pituitary, we're going to get luteinizing hormone and follicular stimulating hormone that are going to come down and stimulate the production of basically estrogen and testosterone. So we see that luteinizing hormone in women will stimulate the theca cells, like Dr. Miles was saying. And with that stimulation of the theca cells, we're going to get the production of androstenone, which is essentially testosterone. So that's all happening within the theca cell. And then in the granulosa cell in women, we're going to basically get that testosterone conversion to estrogen with that aromatase enzyme. Now let's back up again. So the luteinizing hormones affecting the theca cells and helping with the production of testosterone in women. That testosterone is going to move over to a different cell, the granulosa cell, but it's the stimulation of this additional hormone from the pituitary that's actually going to cause that testosterone to change to estrogen with this aromatase enzyme.
So when we think the follicular phase of that first phase of a woman's menstrual cycle, follicular stimulating hormone is a big part of that phase. And follicular stimulating hormone is binding to the receptor sites in those granulosa cells and stimulating the aromatization of testosterone into estrogen. So it adds an aroma onto the testosterone to make it into estrogen, basically. And so this HPG axis, so just like we talked about HPA axis for adrenal hormones, hypothalamic pituitary adrenals, here we're talking about HPG, hypothalamic pituitary gonadal axis, sometimes referred to in women as the HPO because the ovaries are the gonads for women. So HPG or HPO axis would be synonymous terms, but we're going to mostly just refer to it as the HPG for the most part. And because that we can refer to both sexes as having the hypothalamic pituitary gonadal axis. And so remember, it begins in the hypothalamus with the release of gonadotropin releasing hormone, and that releases the gonadotropes, which are luteinizing hormone, and follicular stimulating hormone, which are released from the pituitary, and the pituitary gets stimulated by that GnRH. And then the LH binding more to theca cells to create the testosterone, and the FSH binding more to the granulosa cells, which is creating more estrogen, and those granulosa cells are more centered in that follicle, and as that follicle grows and matures in that follicular phase, there are more granulosa cells, which means more receptors for FSH, which means greater production of estrogen. So that'll explain a little bit why that estrogen starts to rise in that first half of the cycle.
And those granulosa cells are found in the corpus luteum. So that's part of, as this corpus luteum's growing, it's producing progesterone, but since it's actually also containing those granulosa cells and the granulosa produce estrogen, that's why as the corpus luteum is maintained, that the estrogen levels in the second half of the cycle will raise slightly.
Yeah, so first they drop at ovulation significantly, and then they'll rise slightly. Part of that rise slightly is some of the granulosa cells are still there and still aromatizing testosterone.
Now the other thing that's happening here is we have a production of inhibin, and inhibin is going to come back and negatively feedback FSH. Now remember, with hormonal cycles, we always have this negative feedback loop, right? Where lower glands, meaning further down, further away from the brain, are going to come back and tell the brain basically to produce more or less hormones. So everything's always communicating. So we see that inhibin is one way. We have multiple ways that we're going to have communication between the gonads and the hypothalamus and pituitary. One way is with inhibin, which is going to come back to the pituitary and inhibit FSH.
So that makes sense, right? FSH, when it gets high, stimulates and binds more to the receptor sites in the granulosa cells to produce more estrogen, but we don't want to keep eternally producing more and more and more. It needs to be in balance. So part of the feedback mechanism of how we regulate that estrogen levels in the body is that those granulosa cells, while they aromatize the testosterone into estrogen, also secrete inhibin, and that inhibin then downregulates the FSH so it doesn't spin out of control. So that helps the body to have the feedback mechanism to be able to keep those hormone levels in balance. In particular, estrogen is kept in balance by the inhibin inhibiting the FSH, and that FSH being the one that binds to the granulosa cells that aromatizes testosterone into estrogen. So is this part pretty clear now, or are there any questions or thoughts on this? So just if there are, type them in the Q&A or bring them up here and we'll address as we go along. So we want to sort of, it's very complex. We want to get clear each step of the way. And then when we get to the cycle where we see all the hormones doing their different rising and falling, this background should give you a real understanding for, oh, that's why estrogen's doing that then and then that the later part. And so that should so help you to be able to understand this a lot better.
So we'll build on this more as we go. The other piece of this that is pretty clear in this picture is inhibin, from what we can tell in the research, more directly will provide negative feedback to the pituitary. So it's working to provide that negative feedback to FSH. But you see this other negative feedback mechanism happening.
Positive or negative.
Positive or negative, true. From the gonads. So estrogen and progesterone can come up and give information to the hypothalamus about gonadotropin releasing hormone.
Yeah.
And we're going to get into why that matters and more of this later. But just to give the first part of the chart there.
Did we get the previous slide right before
that? That's what I'm going back to, yeah. So here's another piece of this too that we can address now is fast and slow release. So we see that gonadotropin releasing hormone is able to basically stimulate LH and FSH. So why would it stimulate LH sometimes and FSH other times? So what we've seen in the research is that if it's released from the hypothalamus in a fast pulsation manner, that actually triggers LH from the pituitary. If it's released from a slow manner, that's going to triggulate FSH from the pituitary. So, and we will get, as we go into the negative feedback, we'll see that estrogen and progesterone are going to stimulate the hypothalamus in different ways to have fast or slow release, and that's how it's going to send the signal to the pituitary about which hormone to release.
And then also inhibin is going to play a role in inhibiting FSH. So if inhibin levels are high, then the FSH part of it gets inhibited, but not necessarily the LH part of it. So that may also factor in to the regulation. So
we saw with the adrenal glands in that module, we saw that there's a biphasic mechanism where there's almost like this check and balance of the inhibition and secretion cycles of the hormonal system. And we're kind of seeing that here too with female and male anatomy and physiology, that there's a couple mechanisms at play. There's a check and balance. We have the inhibin that can basically provide feedback to the pituitary and change FSH secretion. And then we also have progesterone and estrogen that provide information to the hypothalamus that can also provide that information. So we have two different ways we're getting signals back to the brain.
And also, just like with the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, it's becoming more and more well recognized that receptor site activity, how much synthesis of that receptors there are in different glands, and the resistance or sensitivity to those hormones is playing a big role in certain conditions and issues. So there's definitely, in addition to just the hormone levels, there's a big difference between different people in terms of how many receptor sites are being synthesized and how sensitive those sites are to the hormone. So that's going to be important as well.
So in male side is going to look very similar. We're going to have a hypothalamic secretion of GnRH. We are going to get a pituitary release of LH and FSH, and that's going to trigger the testes to basically secrete testosterone and then eventually to make sperm.
And we'll talk about the cells that are involved in that, but there are some similarities and parallels that can be helpful, like LH, we know, for women, binds to the FACA cells and creates testosterone from cholesterol. LH in men binds to the Leydig cells, and that creates testosterone from cholesterol. So there are some parallels, but we'll talk in more detail about the different dimensions of the male HPG as well.
So just to go over a little bit of a hormonal review, so we are reminded of what the roles of each of these hormones are in our body. Estrogen in women is going to be produced in female glands, in ovaries, in the liver, in the adipocytes, and in the breast tissue. And in the ovaries, we're going to see, just as we had just said, that it's going to be converted from testosterone into estrogen by the aromatase enzyme. So in general, it's going to be pretty low, except at ovulation. We're going to get a surge at ovulation of estrogen. Then estrogen is going to fall. And then with the secretion of estrogen from the corpus luteum, from the granulosa cells, we'll get a slight increase that will be maintained throughout the second half of the cycle. And then we see in males that estrogen is produced in the adrenals, in the liver, in the adipocytes, in the mammary glands, and in the gonads. So pretty similar locations of production.
So we have three kinds of estrogen, E1, E2, and E3. And E1, estrone, is easy to remember because the O-N-E at the end is 1. So that's kind of nice. That helps us remember estrone is E1. And that's the most predominant during pregnancy. So that's the most common kind of estrogen in the body while a woman is pregnant. Estradiol, so diol, di is like a meaning 2, so estradiol is E2, then that's the strongest and is the strongest form of estrogen, and it's the most common for non-pregnant women. And then estriol, so tri, 3, E3, is the most abundant, or it's the weakest form.
And the most abundant. So, and then we also see that in general, estrogen will accelerate metabolism, but when it's out of balance, we're going to see fat storage. So estrogen is going to allow that endometrium to grow. It's going to cause those endometrial cells to multiply. So we see that growth of things. And in right amounts, we can actually, estrogen will expedite the metabolism, but a lot of these hormones, when they get out of balance, then it can cause the opposite to happen. So out of balance, we can get fat storage.
And maintenance of healthy libido and vaginal lubrication is an important function of estrogen. And so we see estrogen being, as it declines for women during menopause, we see vaginal dryness and libido drops. So that's in part due to estrogen changes. Now, testosterone changes can also contribute to libido issues, but we do see estrogen playing that role. So if we think growth and development, if we think the capacity for being able to care, we'll talk more about the mind stuff, but think about it from a consciousness perspective as well as a physiologic perspective, and think about the female sex characteristics physically, but also think about that sensuality and some of the drives that estrogen might have from a consciousness perspective as well as a physiologic perspective, because that'll help clue you into when that can be an issue. And we'll get into this later, but sometimes estrogen levels are different in different tissues. So getting an overall estrogen lab will be somewhat revealing. But for example, in the case of endometriosis, which we'll cover later, the endometrial estrogen can be excessive even if the serum or urine estrogen metabolites are normal. And there can be several fold times as much estrogen that's causing problems in certain areas, like in the case of endometriosis. So it's good for us to, you know, we're probably not going, most of us going to biopsy the endometrium to look for estrogen levels there. So it's good for us to have also some understanding when the labs are going to, you know, maybe not give us the level of depth of information that we need, to have an understanding of the functions so that we can also see a little bit about when they might be different in different tissue levels and might be an issue in certain areas.
So estrogen is going to provide a lot of other functions too. We see that it increases nitric oxide. Nitric oxide is a vasodilator, so it can help to then lower blood pressure if it's in proper amounts. So the estrogen is very, we do see a lot of cardiovascular protective functions in general. So in addition to lowering blood pressure, it can increase HDL, cholesterol, can increase apolipoprotein A, can decrease LDL and apolipoprotein B. So all of really good characteristics with estrogen. Although one interesting thing that we see is that despite all of these great cardiovascular functions that it does, it also tends to raise triglycerides. So we need to be very aware of that if women are on things like hormone replacement therapy, that triglycerides would be a common side effect of having those increase.
Well, and a clinical aside on hormone replacement therapy is that although estrogen is protective for cardiovascular issues, and although there's definite strong research associating drops and declines in estrogen with increased cardiovascular illness and issues, it was assumed that, okay, let's just replace the estrogen and then cardiovascular benefits will go up. But unfortunately, hormone replacement did not improve cardiovascular and most function in most research. So the hormone replacement sort of idea of let's just replace this hormone and then we'll get those cardiovascular benefits because we see these as functions of estrogen did not work with some of the pharmaceutical hormone replacement therapies. Now, bioidenticals aren't as well researched, so it's a little more tricky to figure out, well, if was it because of the synthetic compound? Is it, you know, would bioidenticals be different? We don't really know, but we do know that the research that is available presently on hormone replacement has not seen the cardiovascular benefits that would have been expected based on the research showing declining estrogen levels associated with cardiovascular issues. So that's interesting.
So we also see that estrogen has antioxidant properties. We see that it can prevent the oxidation of HDLs, LDLs. So it's cardioprotective from that function as well, just protecting that cholesterol. And then other things to know about estrogen are looking at xenoestrogen. So xenoestrogens are basically anything that can bind to those estrogen receptors and mimic estrogen, can stimulate an estrogen-like response. We see that phytoestrogens are a category of xenoestrogens. So these are the estrogen mimickers that are from plant sources. Versus a lot of times when we're talking about xenoestrogens, we are specifically referring to more toxic forms of estrogen mimickers, such as PCBs or bisphenol A, these environmental toxins that are actually going to, you know, stimulate estrogen. But if we're classifying things, phytoestrogens are actually a type of xenoestrogen. They just are more from plant sources and do have uses with certain conditions we'll talk about. So the other thing we see that as these xenoestrogens bind to the receptors, that is going to trigger an estrogen response, but it's going to be a weaker response. So it's not going to be as strong of a response as actually an estrogen molecule itself.
And remember, estradiol was the strongest estrogenic response. Progesterone. So The main production of progesterone, now progesterone gets produced in a variety of places, but the main production is the corpus luteum. And that is mainly produced during that luteal phase, the second half of a woman's menstrual cycle for a menstruating woman. So we see that progesterone levels are going to increase significantly during that luteal phase, during that second half of the cycle. And this is going to be super important for a variety of menstrual issues. So we're definitely going to talk a lot about progesterone levels and how they can get dysregulated and how that can contribute to a variety of issues for women and their cycles. And we do see also that adrenal glands, adipose tissue, and nervous tissue also do produce some progesterone. So it's not solely from the corpus luteum, but primarily it is.
So it's going to inhibit gonadotropin-releasing hormone. Remember, we said that estrogen and progesterone are going to provide that feedback cycle to the hypothalamus to let the hypothalamus know what needs to happen as far as GnRH release and secretion. So we will get an inhibition from progesterone there.
And think about pro being for and gest, like gestation, and then ohm tells you it's a hormone. So this is a progestation hormone, a for gestating, for developing a child kind of a hormone. This is the functions of progesterone are going to be a lot about how to maintain a pregnancy. And so the uterine preparation for gestation and the endometrial changes in the lining of the uterus are going to be impacted significantly by progesterone, and that's going to prepare that uterine lining for implantation of a fertilized egg, if there is a fertilized egg. And it's going to keep that fertilized egg. It makes vascular changes. There are all these veins and blood flow that come into the endometrium that's going to be feeding that fetus if there is impregnation. And so progesterone serves this function for bearing children. And it makes sense then a little bit about why it might inhibit GnRH, because you don't need to be developing more follicles if you have a fertilized egg that is being nourished and you're wanting to devote the attention, the body wants to devote the attention to growing that fetus and not new follicles.
So we also see that it helps develop mammary glands. It also is going to help with libido. So it's going to be an important hormone for libido. And then this is also a really important thing in understanding the physiology of things like PMS and PMDD, which is that progesterone is going to enhance serotonin. So we see oftentimes that a pathogenesis like of PMS or PMDD is that the progesterone levels are not high enough. That progesterone never reaches that level that we really want. And we can see why that could lead to depression. Around the cycle is that with progesterone, if it's enhancing serotonin receptors, if it's not getting to the level of high to the peak that it really needs to get to, then we're not going to get that enhancement of the serotonin receptors like we want, and therefore depression can happen. And then we also see that progesterone is going to reduce spasms, it's going to relax smooth muscle. So all of that will allow for a more comfortable menses for women to have that progesterone reach that height. Now, reach its peak is going to help reduce the spasm. So we can now that we understand this is one of the things that progesterone does, we can start to understand why cramping and some of these PMS symptoms happen if progesterone levels don't reach their peak.
And let's understand also why the decrease in spasm and contraction is important for the function of progestation hormone. Basically, that uterus, if it's implanted with a fertilized egg, you don't want that uterus to contract too much, and it's a protective function for that fetus. to relax that muscle in particular, but it's going to have effects elsewhere as well.
So it's also interesting to know that progesterone can have a reductionistic effect on gallbladder activity. So we might want to consider that if people are, say, having a hard time digesting fat, you know, towards the end of their cycle, that perhaps that's a mechanism of progesterone and they might need a little bit of support around that. And also if women are pregnant, that we could get a reduction in gallbladder activity as well throughout the pregnancy. So we might want to support that.
And that makes sense too, right? Because what does the gallbladder do to release the bile? It contracts. It squeezes the bile out. So the liver makes the bile, sends it to the gallbladder to store. When we eat a fatty meal, the gallbladder contracts to send that bile through the common bile duct into the small intestine. But if there's not as much contraction and the smooth muscles are more relaxed, then there might be, you know, an issue there. So cholagogue herbs might be helpful, especially in that case, that help with gallbladder contractility.
And is that when peristalsis slows down and they get pregnant women tend to get constipated?
So the question is this why peristalsis slows down and women tend to get constipated? I haven't seen anything showing directly that it's going to affect the peristalsis of the gut that progesterone would, but certainly
the gut is smooth muscle, so it could
potentially
make sense mechanistically,
mm-hmm.
and certainly impaired bile flow can contribute to constipation as well.
Right. So, and the other thing on here is that progesterone will increase body temperature. So that spike in body temperature, which just tends to be about 0.5 degree Fahrenheit, that spike of body temperature around ovulation is a mechanism of progesterone. So it's as we get that surge of progesterone moving into the system with that corpus luteum that we get that temperature going up. And temperature, that spike in temperature we see at ovulation tends to, if progesterone is high enough as it's supposed to be, tends to stay throughout the rest of the cycle and into pregnancy. So if we're seeing that progesterone is not spiking as high, we might not see that temperature maintained throughout that second half of the cycle like we should expect.
And that temperature increase allows for one way of assessing hormone levels to be what's called basal body temperature. And we'll talk about that in testing as one option for helping women to assess for what different hormone levels are doing during different times of the month. And so, especially if people are having trouble affording a different kind of a lab test, it's something that people can do at home for themselves. It's a lot of work, but it is an accurate way of assessing for hormonal changes due in part to the increased temperature resultant from progesterone.
So looking at progesterone's effect on men, the main production is going to be just purely in the adrenal glands in men. And progesterone is going to impact spermiogenesis. It's going to impact that creation of sperm. It's going to impact the capacitation, the maturity of the sperm. And it's also going to impact testosterone synthesis. So it really, even though it's lower levels in men, it has a great impact on male fertility.
And it also regulates some of the proliferative effects of estrogen. So estrogen in excess can have proliferative effects and increase growth, in particular cancer growth, like prostate for men, breasts for women. So prostate cancer and breast cancer are often related to and sometimes sensitive to estrogen. And so there's proliferative effects of estrogen that are in part counteracted by or regulated by progesterone levels.
And we're going to see that show up in endometriosis as well, which has that huge estrogen relationship that there's a problem we're seeing as one of the mechanisms of action with endometriosis of progesterone not able to protect against estrogen.
And we'll also see how liver detoxification of estrogen into its metabolites are going to determine a little bit about how proliferative or protective that estrogen is. So we'll talk all about that later.
So other things to know is There's a little bit of research showing that progesterone can perhaps have a protective effect on the mitochondria. The thought process behind it is that a metabolite of progesterone is going to actually influence the channels that are allowing molecules, nutrients, toxins in and out of the mitochondria itself. And progesterone has a positive impact on regulating those. The research on that's pretty minimal at this point. So I don't think we should go too far down on that, but just know that there is some research showing that. And, you know, there might be more that comes out later on mitochondrial support.
And progesterone, although we may talk a little bit more about deficiency clinically, excess is also a problem. And excess is, you know, not completely uncommon, especially because progesterone creams are readily available over the counter and people can self-supplement and may or may not know dosage that's proper. So excessive progesterone can contribute to hyperinsulinemia, to too much insulin resistance, and weight gain. So, you know, too little and too much, both a problem. We have this U-curve, we have this sweet spot that we want to hit with most all hormone levels.
So then testosterone and the physiology behind testosterone. So we see that it's produced in the testes in men, the ovaries in women, and the adrenals in both. It's an anabolic hormone, so it's building. So it's going to, in both men and women, contribute to that lean muscle mass. It also has an impact, we see in research, on bone mass. So it's really not just estrogen alone that is contributing to bone mass. We actually see research supporting estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone all contributing to healthy bone. And we'll talk about that later in more detail when we get to the osteoporosis section.
And we see that male sex characteristics, like facial hair growth and other sex characteristics that are specific to men, tend to be impacted most significantly by testosterone, and that's analogous to how we talked about female sex characteristics, like breast growth being more responsible, estrogen being more responsible for that. And the prostate, so maintenance of accessory organs like the prostate, are also impacted significantly by testosterone. And both men and women, libido is impacted by testosterone, but libido isn't only impacted by testosterone, it's also impacted by estrogen and progesterone, so all of sex hormones have an impact. But we do commonly see with people who have low levels of testosterone, especially with women, one of the main symptoms can be libido being low, and then also not adequate amounts of muscle growth and perhaps fat, sort of less capacity to burn fat and build muscle is often also associated. And the bone health is associated, but it's also with estrogen, because when estrogen drops, that can also contribute to bone issues. So we'll get more into sorting out the details, but know that it does have, testosterone does have a bone mass function also.
So, and then the mental performance piece of this, just to be transparent about that, the studies around the mental performance are really, they're correlative studies, and they're really just looking and saying, oh, testosterone is declining, mental performance is declining, and forming a relationship. So it's a pretty loose tie right now. You know, definitely we can't say for sure that A causes B, but just that there's been some correlative studies linking them, and perhaps there's a relationship there. So the other thing we see is that insulin resistance can actually raise or lower testosterone. So if we're in a situation where we see testosterone abnormalities of any kind, you know, this is really telling us that we need to look at blood sugar and look at insulin resistance as being a contributory root cause.
And then we see impacts on testosterone from sleep and sleep quality and sleep health. So it's really important to look at sleep when testosterone levels are imbalanced. We also see that calorie restriction can impact testosterone levels. And cortisol imbalances from stressors and or blood sugar dysregulation and or inflammatory signaling or or being contributed to from poor sleep quality, that those cortisol imbalances also can impact and potentially lower testosterone levels.
So this brings us back to the idea that we were saying, you know, a little while ago around why are we talking about the functional physiology, but understanding that there's in research clear statements that poor sleep, calorie restriction, cortisol imbalances can all lower testosterone. We can now look our patients in the eye and say, it's going to be essential that we work on these lifestyle factors if we're going to get your testosterone levels normalized, because we can give all the good supplements and herbs, but if we don't fix this, we don't fix these things, we're really just going against the brick wall. So fixing these lifestyle things become pretty essential when we understand that they do greatly impact testosterone levels.
And when we're asking people to make changes that are significant and difficult for them to do, if they don't understand the reason why, the motivation isn't going to be the same as if they have a mechanistic understanding and link, oh, I understand that I have low testosterone by this lab result and part of my low libido and my breast tissue development or whatever might be in part due to this low testosterone, high estrogen situation, and I understand that my blood sugar dysregulation can impact this enzyme or something that has to do with my testosterone getting lower and estrogen getting higher. So by not eating the sweets, I'm actually going to help my libido. If people can make that link and that link can be understood, that can be huge for motivating not eating sweets. If we just say, oh, it's healthy for you to not eat sweets, well, people already know that, and they're still eating sweets. So we have to deal with situations that people are doing, especially lifestyle changes, in a way that's going to give them strong purpose and reasons why, that's going to help motivate and sustain people. Because oftentimes, you know, we're going to ask for people to make permanent changes or changes for months of time. And even if a person gets on board initially with just a reason like, oh, it's good for your health and I know I should do it, it's not necessarily that reasoning might not sustain in the face of peer pressure, in the face of delicious looking sweets in front of them. But if they have that mechanistic reason and they're like, wow, I'm really trying to work on my libido, I'm really trying to work on this prostate issue, then they can really start to be motivated to understand why they're making the changes and get a sense of resolve about, okay, you know, I'm creating this resolve and here's why, and I have good reasons for it. And so it helps people with making and maintaining lifestyle changes.
So if I tell a patient, hey, I think you need to sleep more, I think that would be a useful thing for you. Or if I tell a patient, hey, we see research that not sleeping enough and sleeping poorly is lowering your testosterone, it's the question of which one of those things are going to actually motivate them to change more. And, you know, a lot of reasons why people are not sleeping well are maybe not good sleep hygiene or staying up too late to take care of that last task or, you know, pushing themselves in other ways. So it becomes a question around presenting to people values and what's more valuable, having testosterone fixed and having the, you know, hormones start to re-regulate and all the benefits that come with that, or, you know, having the lights on, stimulating melatonin or suppressing melatonin production at the end of the day, or doing that last little task that really could be done tomorrow that's going to get the brain revved up. So when we present it and when people understand, like, well, actually, yeah, I do think having my hormone balance is more important to me than that last task, that's going to be an easier motivator for them to actually say, okay, well, I will change my sleep hygiene, because they directly can see it's not just the doctors telling them something that they've read online and heard in a bazillion different places, but they actually can see, oh, there's research saying this will impact that thing that is specific to them, versus just these generalities that I think a lot of us feel can be applied to anybody.
And a lot of people already know that they should be doing something different, but they're not, because they don't have sufficient motivation or understanding of purpose, where they've heard conflicting information and they don't know which is correct and which isn't. So we need to give compelling reasons why, so that people can, when someone else tells them something different, but doesn't give a mechanistic explanation, they can hold strong to their resolve because they have an understanding of a reason why. So unless or until they get a better reason why to do something different, at least they're going to be able to stay stronger in their conviction towards the changes that are going to be helpful for them.
So inhibin. So this is that hormone we already mentioned that is produced, that's basically going to have an impact on the brain. It's going to have an impact on that pituitary gland to inhibit that follicular stimulating hormone in both men and women. And with that inhibition of follicular stimulating hormone, we're going to get a gonadal inhibition as well.
And inhibin is released by those granulosa cells in women. So we showed you that diagram where the FSH binds to the receptor site on the granulosa cell that then aromatizes testosterone into estrogen and simultaneously releases inhibin hormone to feed back to the pituitary to decrease that FSH as a result of having made some estrogen. Because FSH, the purpose of it, is to tell women to make estrogen. And if it's achieved its purpose, the inhibin, it's like communicating to the pituitary, okay, job done. You know, you've done that process of aromatizing the testosterone into estrogen. So the inhibin is sort of like that messenger that's saying, all right, good job. You can, you know, you've done your job. So then you can downregulate that signal. So it's sort of like if we're telling a child to, you know, sort of, if we're telling a teacher of a child, you know, if we have a child and we're telling the teacher, oh, I'd really like for the child, or a tutor, I'd really like for the child to learn this. And, you know, the tutor comes back and said, you know, gives you some papers and says, okay, your child's done this. Then we get the feedback. We don't need to keep telling the tutor again. So it's sort of that mechanism of that feedback loop of the hypothalamus, or sorry, the pituitary getting the signal that, okay, job has been achieved. The signal has been received by the granulosa cell, and the granulosa cell has aromatized the testosterone into estrogen. So now we can downregulate a little bit of that FSH production for that job having been done.
So remember, the purpose of FSH is really to develop that follicle, to get it ready to a point where it could be fertilized. So when we're in the luteal phase, when we're in the second half of the cycle, we don't really need that to happen because that's already happened. We already do have a oocyte that's basically ready to be fertilized. So that's where this inhibition is so important, because there's no point in causing that follicular development. We can save that for later. So FSH really doesn't have a purpose in the proliferation of the species in that second half of the cycle.
So remember, again, those granulosa cells, as the follicle develops, become more and more and more. So there are more receptors for that FSH. So that FSH then, as it binds and achieves its function more and more and more, can inhibit that FSH, because once it reaches that critical threshold of a mature follicle, then it no longer needs that anymore. So that inhibition gets strong enough that it keeps that level of FSH really low. And in men, the Sertoli cells are cells that are in the seminiferous tubules, in the gonads, in the testes. There are these seminiferous tubules where the semen is produced. And in those seminiferous tubules, there are Sertoli cells. And the Sertoli cells have FSH receptors. And when FSH binds to the Sertoli cells together, FSH and testosterone help signal to the Sertoli cells to make something called ABP, which is an androgen-binding protein. And that androgen-binding protein together with testosterone is going to signal the production of sperm. But we'll get a little more into that detail a little later. Just know the Sertoli cells in men, just like the granulosa cells in women, have receptor sites for FSH, and they produce inhibin to signal that the function of that FSH has been completed.
So then looking at cosmic cycles, so we know that there's a sun cycle. We talk about the sun cycle, the 24-hour cycle in the adrenal module, that there is a natural rhythm that we have with the adrenals to basically wake up in the morning around the time that the sun comes up, and that the cortisol is declining in the evening when sun goes down. So another cycle we see that's really connects us to nature is the moon cycle. So from a mind aspect, part of looking at the physiology of the cosmic cycle is questioning a woman and exploring with a woman what her relationship is to life and to the ups and downs, the ebbs and flows of life, and to nature itself. And we see that the menstrual cycle often will follow the moon cycle. Oftentimes it's the new moon cycle that is corresponding the beginning of the new moon with day one of the cycle. Sometimes we see that it's the full moon that does that. But when we work with female hormone imbalances, or when women get together in groups all with different cycles and spend a lot of time together, and is a common thing we see as women, is that our cycles often will align. And this phenomenon is oftentimes they will align with the moon cycle. So there's absolutely something that's happening here that is perhaps beyond what we have a scientific explanation of right now, because we do see this happen often with women when we're balancing them, when they're balancing their hormones, when they're helping balance their own hormones, that this type of cycle is started to be attuned to.
And we know that a healthy cycle follows a moon, even though we talk about it as a month cycle, it generally follows more of a lunar calendar, more of a 28-day month rather than a 30 or 31-day calendar sun cycle month. So we do see those hormones following more that moon cycle, more that lunar calendar. And we do see a lot of cultures that, you know, for many thousands of years have spoken to the moon relating more to the feminine and the sun relating more to the masculine. And we do see these masculine types of qualities to cortisol and these feminine types of qualities to the reproductive hormone menstrual cycle that follows the moon. Now, of course, both men and women have estrogen, both men and women have testosterone and cortisol, but we do see these sorts of, you know, female sex characteristics from estrogen, male sex characteristics from testosterone. And we do see that these are part of what makes the difference between different genders. And we do see that the moon cycle, and when a woman is able to align with the moon and have a regular cycle, I mean, we definitely know and see research that regularity of cycle is important for hormone regulation, and irregular cycles, either too short, too long, or short, long, are problematic and are signs of hormone imbalance. So we do see that there's some research not directly aligning the cycle with the moon specifically in terms of full or new timed with menses, but we definitely do see research that that approximate 28 days, which is equivalent to the lunar calendar, is a sort of considered a very healthy cycle if it's regularly 28 days, month after month after month.
So I'm looking at a pictorial graph of what's happening here. So at the onset of menstruation, remember, that is the beginning of day one of the cycle. And that's that follicular phase we see up until ovulation. So the first half being follicular, we can see these hormones illustrated here. So in red, we have follicular stimulating hormone. That's pretty low throughout throughout the entire follicular phase until right around ovulation.
Next slide is a bigger picture of that part.
So, and then we see luteinizing hormone is also pretty low throughout the follicular phase until...
So it's the green one.
That's the green one until ovulation, in which we get that spike. We can also see at ovulation, right before ovulation, we're getting that increase in estradiol. And then right at ovulation, we're beginning to get that increase in progesterone, which is going to stay pretty high until the end of the luteal phase. And notice, you know, right here, mid-luteal phase is where progesterone tends to be the highest, which is why with lab testing, when we're trying to figure out when to have females get their hormones tested, we're often telling them depending on how long their cycle is, somewhere around like 18 to 22, sometimes as early as 17, sometimes as late as 23, but generally around 18 to 22. And what we're really capturing there here, what we're really asking in this lab test is this progesterone getting as high as we want? Because we want to see that at the maximum peak during that time. And if we don't see that, that's when we're going to be alerted that progesterone is not raising to its maximum levels. And then we're going to start to be suspicious about if that's the cause for things like the depression-related PMDD or the cramping with PMS, these type of symptoms.
So remember, lab testing, if we get a blood test or a urine test, it's a snapshot in time. There are ways to test through the whole cycle. We'll talk about that. But generally and often, there is a benefit to doing a snapshot in time at the right time, and that right time for progesterone, which often we want to see where that's at, is going to be in that 18 to 22 day window. And we go back to the... And then we see the, as we talked about, the body temperature. So the body temperature, we see that that is lowest during the first half of the cycle, and then it rises up at ovulation. And then it goes down a tiny bit, but it stays pretty high because, remember, what was one of progesterone's functions? To raise body temperature. So we see that being playing a role in the body temperature, and that's how a basal body temperature system will be effective, is through understanding that body temperature change throughout the month, and it can tell us when ovulation is happening and how long those progesterone levels are staying high for in the second half of the cycle. And both of those things are really important information to have. Now, also on the follicle side, so we see that the follicle starts really small as an immature follicle, and gradually several follicles, remember I said several of them, are developing in that first half of the cycle, in that follicular phase. So in that follicular phase, and notice how it says menstruation here. So menstruation is in that follicular phase, is in that first half of the cycle. This is important to educate women on sometimes, because if we ask what date did your cycle begin, if we recommend that they do a lab test on day 21, for example, but they don't know that day one is the beginning of bleeding, then, you know, some women just think, oh, I finished bleeding, and they start counting. So, you know, if a woman, if we're asking for lab testing, it's good to be really clear and make sure that they understand that they start counting right at bleeding. So just notice that, and that's helpful. And then so that follicle developing, so the immature follicle develops, and you see the oocyte, the egg inside of it. So the follicle is getting bigger and bigger, and as the follicle gets bigger and bigger, then one of the follicles, which is considered to be a mature follicle and what's referred to as a dominant follicle, is what's chosen at ovulation. So the body chooses the dominant follicle that's mature to release the egg, the oocyte, from the follicle, out of the ovary, and it gets swept into the fallopian tube and gets prepared to be able to be accessible to sperm for implantation. Now, that body then, see how it starts to get the yellow here? That yellow, that's, remember, corpus luteum has to do with the Latin for yellow. So we see that body, it contracts a little bit. The follicle, the dominant follicle, contracts a little bit because that egg left it and left out of the ovary. But the follicle stays in the ovary, contracts a little bit, and that's the corpus luteum. So the corpus luteum then, in that luteal phase, is that body, and that body still starts secreting a lot of progesterone, and then eventually will start to break down if it's not signaled to do otherwise by the implantation of the egg into the uterine wall and the release of another hormone. So the corpus luteum starts degenerating, and that's when progesterone levels start to fall and estrogen levels start to fall towards the end of the cycle is that corpus luteum is degenerating, so it's no longer producing those two. And notice how that luteinizing hormone, how it goes way down and it stays way down, and follicular stimulating hormone stays way down also in that luteal phase. Remember, what does progesterone inhibit? GnRH, gonadotropin-releasing hormone, which produces LH and FSH. And then inhibin, suppresses FSH specifically in the pituitary, but progesterone inhibits GnRH, which is the signal to the pituitary to produce both LH and FSH. So progesterone is inhibiting that, and that makes sense, right? If progesterone is high, let's say a woman was impregnated, then we would want LH and FSH to stay inhibited, and progesterone would stay high, and that corpus luteum would not break down, and that corpus luteum would stay secreting those hormones to help to maintain the pregnancy. So the uterine, the wall, the lining, the endometrium, you see after menstruation, it sheds a lot of the mucus and the blood, but as progesterone rises, it increases the blood flow to the area. And so estrogen helps build that wall, and then progesterone helps thicken that wall and bring a bunch of blood flow and get prepared for giving a bunch of the mother's nutrition to the potential for perhaps a fetus and impregnated egg. But if the egg does not end up being fertilized, then that corpus luteum breaks down and that triggers the cycle to begin again. So there's always the preparation for just in case there is a fertilized egg, and that's a big part of the function for this menstrual cycle.
So another area where understanding this pathophysiology is so helpful with understanding disease processes is it's theorized that one of the contributing factors to development of PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, is due to a lack of being able to select for this dominant follicle. So this process that Miles was talking about here that's happening from the maturing follicle going into ovulation and that need to select that dominant follicle, which is actually going to be the one that's selected to be swept into the fallopian tubes. What can happen at PCOS, at least what's theorized in research, is that there's a lack of that selection, and then we have no follicles that are dominant, and those follicles are actually what turn into the cysts. So that's kind of the thought as to what's happening here. And some of the research that we'll get into later is suggesting that part of what is preventing that dominant follicle from being selected is sympathetic dominance. So, you know, again, another area where just this mind impacts us, it's, you know, and this is still a new idea in research, so there's still more that needs to be gathered here, but it's definitely suggestive that this process of moving from the, you know, picking that dominant follicle, moving into ovulation, really needs a parasympathetic state. So moving people into a more relaxed state, moving people into some of these working with the mind processes become really important for this whole process of procreation.
And then another thing that's worth mentioning for understanding a little bit about how this works is with estrogen and estrogen's rising in that first half of the cycle. And LH is, you know, staying mostly low, and then it has that sudden surge. Well, what's causing that sudden surge? So what happens with estrogen is that when estrogen is at low-ish levels, but it's rising in that first half of the follicular phase, so even before this big increase, in those first about 10 days, estrogen levels are at a low enough level that they're actually having an inhibitory kind of an effect, you know, to gonadotropin-releasing hormone, but there's something that flips when estrogen levels get sufficient. So when those granulosa cells are binding enough FSH, and when they're sufficient enough, which usually it's around day 10, to cross a certain threshold of estrogen. When that certain threshold is crossed, there are a couple things that we see potentially happening in research, and so we'll give you a couple, two different scenarios that are theorized to be what's happening in this phase to let that estradiol level go way up, and that luteinizing hormone to go way up. So one idea is that when estrogen reaches this certain threshold, all of a sudden it triggers the brain on to produce a bunch of extra LH and FSH, but that FSH is getting inhibited by the inhibin, so that LH we see a big rise in, and the FSH we just see a small rise in. And then
there's another theory that's looking on at that fast and low release of that gonadotropin-releasing hormone, basically suggesting at ovulation there is more of a fast release of the gonadotropin-releasing hormone, leading to higher amounts of luteinizing hormone, and some slow release as well. So there, it is a pulsatile thing. So there is some slow release, but the majority of that release of gonadotropin is in this fast type of way, leading to the higher amounts of luteinizing hormone relationship to follicular stimulating hormone.
So they may both be at play, but those are the ideas around why we see that sudden rise in luteinizing hormone. But estrogen has to reach a certain threshold in order for that to happen. So in anovulation, meaning no ovulation, there might not be sufficient levels of estrogen to trigger that response. And so, but when we see that there's healthy ovulation, those estrogen levels get sufficiently high enough to trigger that response. If there's excessive estrogen, it might trigger an early ovulation before the follicles are really ready to be fully matured. So those are some issues that we can see arise from dysregulated hormone levels, and now you can probably understand why that would happen based on what you see from the production of estrogen and how that estrogen and impacts the, and the inhibin impacts the FSH levels and LH levels in the brain.
The other thing to say about this while we have this chart up is the length of a female cycle is going to be most regulated by this surge of estrogen reaching that level that's going to trigger the surge of LH. So in situations where, you know, Miles was talking about where it's like, oh, we have an earlier higher spike of estrogen triggering an earlier higher spike of luteinizing hormone, we're going to expect ovulations perhaps more day 10. It would be early. The luteal phase tends to most of the time be the same for people. So usually if it's a short cycle or a longer cycle, it's really looking at the fact that the estrogen luteinizing hormone relationship is happening earlier or later than we would typically expect. And that's the part as far as looking at what we need to influence when we're re-regulating hormones. It's going to be more looking at influential factors to estrogen and to luteinizing hormone than it would be to progesterone.
So if, for example, there's an early ovulation, what might you think might be happening with estrogen? Might be rising a little too quickly or too high of levels, right? So we'd want to work on lowering potentially estrogen levels or delaying their rise in the case of early ovulation. And we can apply different strategies. But if you understand all this, you could understand how, you know, for example, giving a little bit of progesterone to inhibit GnRH for someone who's having a short cycle might delay that ovulation a little bit if you time it right. And if you delay that ovulation a little bit, that might create a normal cycle again, or a closer to normal cycle. Now, if there's a late cycle, then you might think, okay, estrogen levels might be insufficient, and they might not be reaching their peak until a little too late. So you might be looking at boosting estrogen levels. So this can give you some real insights into practical treatment strategies by understanding this for regulating a menstrual cycle. So it's very useful.